thank you very much for coming out tonight to see me. And I'm actually going to contradict the earlier instructions and tell you that if you have your mobile phones, you can leave them on. Because if any of you happen to use Twitter or something like that, I encourage you, if I say something interesting or smart or stupid, tweet what you think about it. Because one of the fun things I've discovered over the years doing talks with this book is that I'll get off stage and then discover this fascinating list of what people thought I said that was useful, smart, or flat-out idiotic. Useful information for me in either case. So as this slide says, I'm a reporter who studies and writes about the way technology affects the way we think. But I wanted to start not with modern technology, but a little bit of a story of some very old technology, which is Soviet photo manipulation in the middle of the 19th century. So what you're looking at here is some pictures of how Stalin used to get rid of his enemies photographically. After, you can see him standing there in the first one. He's got three commissars standing next to him. Well, one of these poor fellows falls afoul of Stalin. And Stalin either has him killed or sent off to Siberia, hands the photo to his expert photo manipulator and says, wipe this guy out of history. Then he's standing with two other guys. One of those poor gentlemen falls afoul of Stalin. And so he gets erased from history, and now Stalin's only standing with one person. And then something that gentleman did must have annoyed Stalin, because he was erased from history and sent to Siberia, and then Stalin was just standing alone. This is actually the cover of a fabulous book called The Commissar Vanishes. And it's a collection of Soviet photo manipulation. Now, when this was happening back in the middle of the 20th century, this completely terrified intellectuals like George Orwell. Because he thought, correctly, that the average person didn't know that photo manipulation was possible. And so they would see that photo of Stalin standing alone and think, well, that's what it was. There was never anyone with him. And so when he wrote 1984, he based the Ministry of Truth on the idea of photo manipulation, because if you might recall, in the Ministry of Truth, they were constantly rewriting history to try and suit their political demands. And their credo was, he who controls the past controls the present, and he who controls the present controls the future. And so this idea that powerful people would manipulate photos to control history was a real concern, and it actually got even worse up until the 90s, because you had things like Photoshop coming along, right? And I was working at a Canadian newspaper called the Globe and Mail, and the photo editors would come up to me, and they would say, you know, Clive, we are in real trouble here, because like Photoshop is now out all over the place. People could be submitting photos to us that have been doctored, and it'll be done so skillfully, we won't know that it happened. And they were very worried. They had Orwell's fear doubled, you know, 30 or 40 years later. But what actually happened next was very interesting and very unpredictable. Because Photoshop kept on getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, to the point where any laptop you bought just came with a copy of it. And so you gave it to your child, and they wound up just playing around, manipulating photos, and discovering this is kind of a fun thing to do. And so over the next couple of years, you started to get things like this, you know, like pictures of cats with text on it. You know, like this has become one of the greatest memes online. People love putting pictures of cats doctored with silly images like this one, sorry, the couch is full, you know. Or one of my actual personal favorites is one where the cat, I did the math, we can't afford the dog. So what happens, actually, when Photoshop gets really cheap, when anyone can mess around with it because it's practically free on your laptop or there's free copies of it online, everyone just sort of starts discovering it's kind of fun to take photos and erase them and mix them around and mess with them. And it becomes almost kind of a folk art. People get very literate in it. In fact, they get so good at Photoshop that you get websites like this one, You Suck at Photoshop. This is a website that's devoted to people sending in images that have been terribly Photoshopped so that everyone can mock it and laugh at it. I don't know if you can see it very well from here, but this one appears to be someone who created a flyer for, I guess, his burger shop. And since no one has actually showed up, he just cut and pasted a line of people and it's terrible. Like, you know, you can tell they don't belong there. And so there was, like, you know, it's 4,000 comments underneath this photo of everyone laughing their heads off and talking in minute detail about why this was bad. So this is exactly, Orwell could never have seen this coming. He could never have imagined a world where the average person is actually completely literate in photo manipulation. And this turned out to have some really interesting geopolitical implications. Because a couple of years ago, Iran put this photo up on their international news wires. They wanted to boast about the fact that Iran had just launched 4 missiles at the same time. Now, this completely alarmed and disturbed political pundits around the world, because they didn't think Iran was capable of that. And so as soon as that photo went up, they put it on the newspapers all over. The New York Times ran it, and the Chicago Tribune ran it, and they were all going absolutely bonkers about the idea that Iran was so powerful it could launch 4 missiles at one time. Now, what happened next was very interesting, because once that photo went online, all these very visually literate people who've been playing around with Photoshop, they took a look at the picture and they thought, you know, wait a minute, something seems kind of wrong with that picture. And they pulled out their copies of Photoshop and realized that one of the plumes was just cut and pasted version of the other one. That in fact there'd really only been 3 missiles, not 4. And to make itself look more ferocious and powerful, Iran had photoshopped a 4th missile in place, right? Now, keep in mind, the elite photo editors at all the newspapers hadn't seen that. They just ran that photo, you know? But the average people, the people who'd just been playing around with Photoshop and developing this kind of interesting eye for the way this works, they were the ones that figured it out. And of course, once they figured it out, they just started making their own parodies of it. You know, there are hundreds of parodies like this online. Everyone just having fun, laughing at the Iranians. There's one with cats. You know, there's always one with cats. You know, the all fungible meme for the online world. And so this is just a little story to lay out what I want to talk about tonight, which is what types of interesting new forms of cognitive abilities emerge as these tools that used to be very expensive become part of our everyday lives. What is the future of thought as these technologies become something that we use on an everyday basis? Not just for serious things, but for funny things. And what new modes of communications and thinking emerge? Well, so I'm going to try and give you a sort of a 50,000 foot in the air view of what are 3 or 4 of the biggest changes I've seen in my 20 years of traveling around the country and traveling around the planet, talking to people about the types of things they're doing in their everyday lives. One of the first things that became clear to me as I did this is what I call the rise of public thinking, which is what happens as we do more and more of our thinking out loud, in front of other people, just talking about things that are on our mind. You know, because now, of course, you know, with the internet and smartphones, people do an awful lot of sort of casting at broadcasting of little things that they're thinking about. It could be a Facebook post about something, or it could be a photo posted onto Instagram, people talking about it. There's an enormous amount of people talking about things they're seeing, they're doing, they're wondering about. And sometimes I think it's almost hard for us today to realize how weird this is, how little this used to happen in the past. Because if you talk to scholars of rhetoric, people who study writing, they'll tell you that before the internet came along, the average person went to high school, you know, maybe wrote some papers for their teacher, and went to college, maybe wrote some papers for their teacher. And after they graduated, you know, they basically wrote nothing. That was it. You know, nothing for the rest of their life, unless they had a job that required them to pour out text. When I heard about this from scholars of rhetoric, I decided to test it by calling up the one person I know who is completely insulated from the internet, which is my mother. She lives in northern Ontario and has never used a computer and can't type. I called her and I said, "So, Mom, when's the last time you wrote something longer than, like, say, a grocery list? Like something a paragraph in length?" And the phone line went silent. And I said, "Are you still there?" And she's like, "Yes, I'm just thinking about it." And so she said, "Could you narrow it down?" I said, "Well, sure. How about the last year?" And she said, No. I haven't written a paragraph in the last year." I said, "Well, how about the last decade?" And she said, "No, I don't think so." So we went on this sort of archaeological exploration of when was the last time she wrote anything of any length at all. And she's an extremely literate person, great education, Canadian educational system in the 50s and 40s, reads all the time. And she said basically the last time she wrote a lot was probably back in the 70s, before the long distance phone calls killed off her annual Christmas cards to family. So now, of course, we have a much different world. People of all ages up and down do a lot more communication of things they're thinking about. I actually tried to figure out what the sum total of our daily output in words are. So I sat down with some scientists and got some estimates, and we figured out it's about 3.6 trillion words a day is what we're writing on this planet. That's about, to put that in context, that's about the same size as the entire collections of the Library of Congress every single day. Now, those are not all good words, obviously, right? I mean, I think anyone who's been to the discussions at the bottom of a newspaper article has clearly seen, you know? But even if you were to take the portion of it that's good quality, maybe it's only 10%, that is larger in size than any arena of human expression in history. And what particularly interests me is what it does to the minds of us as we do this expression. How does it change the way we think when we're no longer just walking around with our thoughts in our heads? So I talked to a lot of psychologists about this, and they said, well, you know, one of the first things that happens when people start setting something down to show to someone else is that it triggers what they call the audience effect. And the audience effect is exactly what it sounds like. When you go in front of an audience, you suddenly feel the need to be a better version of yourself, to crystallize your thoughts of what am I exactly trying to say, because I have to be persuasive, I have to impress these people. I mean, that's happening to me right now with you guys out there. I mean, I don't talk like this at the kitchen table in the morning, you know. I mean, I'm not as think my concepts are not as well thought out, or with friends at a bar. And they found over and over again that if they ask people to take something they're just thinking about or they've just written for themselves and put it online, like with students, they say, you've written your paper for your teacher. Well, we're going to put that online now so everyone else can see it. And they'll suddenly panic and rewrite it at 40% greater length with greater vocabulary and longer sentences because they're now afraid of looking stupid in front of other people. And they also wrestle, when we have to set things down, we wrestle with what exactly it is we're really thinking. I mean, I'm a writer, and a lot of writers and poets and people I've talked to now who just use the internet will all say, there's this phenomenon where they sit down to say something, and it could be an email, or it could be a letter, or it could be even a tweet, and in the act of writing it, they realize what it is they actually meant to say. Poets have talked about this for years. One of my favorite quotes is from Cecil Day Lewis. He says, you know, we do not write in order to be understood. We write in order to understand, to figure out exactly what it is we're trying to say. And one really good example of this is up in Canada. I'm Canadian. There's a woman I know. She teaches Canadian literature up in Vancouver. And she specifically asks her students to write essays about minor Canadian literary figures. Now, this is not the most compelling subject matter for students, as you might imagine. So they would sort of hand in these half-baked essays they hadn't worked very hard on. And she was always trying to get them to work harder on it, and they wouldn't. So she said, okay, here's what I'm going to do. She asked the kids to take their essays on minor Canadian writers and get them into Wikipedia as Wikipedia entries. So students said, okay, and they took all their essays, and they would, you know, put them into Wikipedia and hit publish, and about 10 seconds later, they were all deleted. Because the Wikipedians are a pretty hard crowd, and they would basically say, you don't have any research, this is badly written, and there's no footnotes, you know, be gone. And the students all came, you know, with tears, you know, streaming down their faces back to the professor, crying, like, you know, what do we do, what do we do? And she said, well, you're going to have to do a better job, you know, rewrite it, you know, put some more research in. And she could see them doing this, you know, resubmitting it over and over again all week long. They would submit it at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Tuesday, and it would get rejected. And then at 10 o'clock at night on Wednesday, and it would get rejected. And 2 in the morning on Thursday, and it would get rejected. Finally, lo and behold, Friday at 4 in the morning, you know, all these essays were finally good enough to get accepted. And when she looked at them, they were so much better quality than anything they'd ever written for her in her class that she said, this is a great quote, you know, the students were often content to get a bad grade from me, but they didn't want the Wikipedia community telling them that their research was lazy and sloppy. Because Wikipedia was a real audience. It was an authentic audience. It was one that talks back and tells you when they think you're stupid. And real authentic audiences bring out our best cognitively. You see this, I mean, you see this at the level of essays and blog posts, but you also see it even with just individual sentences. I live in New York City, so I've gotten in this kind of sneaky habit of riding on the subway and the bus and sort of peering over people's shoulders as they write text messages and tweets. And it's completely fascinating because you'll see people sort of start writing about 8 or 9 words and then erase it down to 1 word and then write another 8 or 9 words and then go back down, they've got 2 words. They'll spend 3 minutes crafting a 17-word utterance, at which point in time I'll tap them on the shoulder and say, I'm sorry, I'm a journalist, I was watching what you were doing. Why did it take so long to write 1 sentence? And they'll say, well, I had to get this right, you know. They're panicking about the quality of their intellectual performance at the level of an individual sentence. Now, once we start doing all this externalization of our thought, the next thing that happens is what scientists call the law of multiples. And the law of multiples is basically something that scientists discovered a long time ago, which is that whenever they were working on something, they might think they're the only ones, you know, working on this difficult problem. But they would publish about it and find that someone in Stockholm was working on the exact same thing, and so was someone in Toronto. Given a large enough group of people, there will always be 10 or 1,000 other weirdos out there who are obsessed with the same strange thing that you're obsessed with that you can't get anyone around you to care about, basically. And so this happens over and over again online. People start, when you start talking aloud about what you're doing, what you're thinking about, you will run into the others who share the same weird, narrow obsession, and they become thinking partners. And there's a really great story that I ran into in my research with this woman, Oria Kolo. She is a she's a Kenyan woman. She went to Harvard to study law, and afterwards she went back down to Kenya, and she became a blogger. She started writing about, this is back in the mid-2000s, started writing about Kenya's economic and political development, because Kenya is a really interesting country. It's very economically dynamic, but it's also very corrupt, and so there's this constant sort of, you know, contrast between the people who are trying to make things better and the corrupt politicians that are just trying to suck all the life out of the society. So she started blogging about this, and she got a kind of a good audience. She had about 1,000 people who would come by every day, and they would comment and talk and sort of send her in news items, and they would have that little nice public thinking dialogue going on. And then in 2007, there was an election that was pretty much straightforwardly rigged by the government. And the Kenyan people decided they'd had enough, and they rose up and they started protesting at the polls. And the government wanted nothing to do with that, so they shut down the media and they sent out their goons to basically start beating down all the protesters. Now, the media was shut down. No one could find out what was going on. The only place you could read what was actually happening was on blogs like those of Oria Kolo. So she was asking all of her readers, you know, please send in any examples you see of any malfeasance at the polls. I want to have a record of what happened. And so people were texting her and emailing her with things they'd seen, and she spent about 24 hours frantically updating her blog with everything she could find. But the 24th hour, when she was exhausted, she sort of thought, my God, there's got to be a better way to do this. And so, you know, because she was accustomed to thinking out loud, she just wrote a little paragraph on her blog saying, you know, wouldn't it be better if there was just some sort of a Google Maps tool that let anyone who saw something happening out there in the field just sort of put a pin on the map, saying, you know, here is where a protester is being beaten by the government? Well, lo and behold, because she was talking out loud and because multiples exist, sure enough, there were a couple of nerds out there that followed her blog who said, yeah, we've been thinking about the exact same thing, and moreover, we actually think we can make this happen. So they got in touch with her, and within 48 hours after her writing that post, they had actually created the tool she was talking about. This is it. It's called Ushahidi. It's a lovely, lovely name. It's Swahili for testimony. And it is used now over and over again in crises. Whenever a crisis happens, it's a free tool. It's an overlay map on Google Maps. And crisis people are managing will put it up on top of Google Maps and tell anyone who has information to put a pin on the map. What you're looking at here is Haiti. This is after the Haitian earthquake. This map went up about 10 minutes after the earthquake struck. And within a few days, it was getting 2,000 pins a day where people were stuck, where they needed help, where they needed water and where water was available. And this became so good a resource that the US military and the United Nations just threw away their own research and were looking at this as the best possible compilation of information about how to manage that catastrophe. Same thing with the BP oil spill, by the way. Where during the BP oil spill, someone put up a map and said, let us know if the oil is washing up on your backyard. And that's exactly what you're seeing. This was the best map available of all the oil. So over and over again, Ushahidi has been used in crisis to get an amazing sense of what's happening on the ground. It has saved countless of lives. And yet, it wouldn't have happened if Oria Kolo wasn't accustomed to thinking in public. To whenever she had something she was wondering about or a problem she was wrestling with, just sort of talk about it out loud and see who responds. And so up until now, I've been talking a lot about, you know, writing in these sort of, these longer forms, these blog posts, these wiki posts. But as came up earlier on when I talked about Twitter, a lot of the way we write these days online is in these very, very short forms. You know, it's like a little short note on Twitter, a short note on Facebook, a tiny conversation on Instagram. And I have to admit, when I first saw Twitter 7 years ago, I thought the end of society was nigh. I mean, I thought, wow, you know, our attention span has shrunk to 140 characters. That's all we can write now. I mean, you know, this is the end, basically. And I joked about it, like this guy joked about it. You know, who really cares what I'm doing every hour of the day? Even I don't care. But what I learned as I studied how people were using it was that I was missing part of the picture. And I actually got part of that picture by talking to this woman, Mimi Ito. She's a Japanese-American anthropologist, and she was famous in the 1990s for studying the way that young Japanese people use their mobile phones. Now, Japan lives about 10 years in the future. So back in the 1990s, they were doing text messaging a lot earlier before we were. And she would talk to these young couples. And the young couples rarely lived in the same place, very expensive real estate, so they would live with their families well into their 20s. And she would discover that after they got back from work, they would just text each other all night long, like about once every 5 or 10 minutes, with some small statement like, I'm getting into the tub now, or, wow, that was a terrible joke on that TV show, or, I regret having bought these shoes, they were too expensive. And they would just do this all night long. And she said to them, you know, you guys are having a relationship, why don't you just pick up the phone and call each other? You know, wouldn't that be a more emotionally satisfying way to talk to each other? And they all told her, they said, well, you know, we do that sometimes, but the truth is, when we send these little messages all night long, we feel more proximal to each other. It's like we're in the same room and just, you know, sharing a comment back and forth or a glance. And she realized that what was going on, that these little messages were like a way of entering someone's virtual peripheral vision. It really is like, for them, it really was like sitting in the living room together, one person reading a book, one person watching TV, and just sort of knowing what's going on in each other's minds through these very small utterances. And this is the paradox of what psychologists now call ambient awareness. Ambient, the idea that one of the things we really enjoy about this media is that it allows us to pay attention to people's minds, what they're saying and what they're doing, through a constellation of very small utterances. And that, you know, if you were to look at my Twitter feed or my Facebook feed for just an hour, it would look just like a bunch of jumbled nonsense. There wouldn't be very much there. You'd see me discussing a CNN article I'd read, and maybe a picture of something I did in the weekend, and then maybe a weird joke someone had told me, and it would just seem like disjointed noise. But if you followed it for a few months, or even for a few years, you'd start to get a much larger picture, the way that a bunch of thousands and thousands of dots make up a large pointless picture. And this really turns out to be the pleasure of this ambient awareness. The ability to follow someone's utterances and their thinking over a long period of time. People would frequently describe it to me as if it felt like they had a form of ESP. They would know what their partner or what their friend in a different city had been thinking about, had been joking about, had been worried about, even if they weren't in regular communication with them. Now, there's also other things that this ambient media does to the way we pay attention. It changes the way we pay attention to the world because it changes who we learn about the world from. Particularly, it expands what sociologists would call our weak ties. So sociologists, they look at the world, they sort of divide things into two groups. There's the strong ties, the weak ties. Now, the strong ties are your very good friends, your spouse, your family. There's not very many of those people, you know, 4 or 5 of them. And they're the ones that you really rely on emotionally. They're the ones that are there for you when you need them. Now, the weak ties are all the hundreds of other people that, you know, you maybe know them vaguely in the town or vaguely in the someone you see once or twice a year in a company you work for, maybe someone you met at a party a year ago, you dimly know. But it turns out that those weak ties are incredibly important in the world of information. And one of the first people to discover this was Marshall Granovetter. He was a sociologist who wanted to know, back in the 70s, how we find our jobs. And so he interviewed a couple hundred people. He said, where did you get your job from? And what he discovered was that the people who found the jobs that were the most interesting, the most satisfying, and paid the best had all heard about their jobs from a weak link, from someone that they saw maybe 2 times a year. Or as he says, they got this amazing information from the existence of someone whose existence they had likely almost forgotten. And now this seems really weird because when you think about it, wouldn't your best friends be the ones trying to get you your job? You know, they'd be like, you know, Clive's an awesome guy. He needs a job. Let's find him a job. The problem with my friends is that they are too informationally similar to me. You know, we read the same things. We tell the same jokes. We watch the same TV shows. We know the same people. So they're unlikely to find a new job for me because we are soaking in the same information. Anything they know, I already know. So the new information is going to come from those far-off people. But before the internet came along, it was pretty hard to stay in touch with those far-off people. I mean, who was going to pick up the phone every week and call 200 people you barely know just to see what's going on, you know? Of course we didn't do that. But this is sort of what happens in ambient media. It becomes easier and easier to sort of notice at the corner of your eye what's going on in the lives and thinking of weak links. In fact, actually, weak links are how I got this, which is my my house in Brooklyn. Here we go. That blue house right there in the center, that's where I live. You can come and stalk me if you want now because you know where it is. Now, I had been looking. Brooklyn is a very, very, very tight real estate market. And I and my wife had been looking for 2 years to try and find a place that we could afford that was near a good public school. And we had failed. We'd been out there every week. And one day, 4 years ago, she was out looking, couldn't find anything. She got on the subway. And when she was underground in the subway, she pulled out her phone. And for some reason, there was Wi-Fi. And she thought, well, that's kind of interesting. So she went onto Facebook, and she just said, you know, who knew? There's Wi-Fi in the F stop at South End of Brooklyn. And of course, you know, people who saw this at the corner of their eye immediately asked her, oh, you know, what are you doing there? And she said, well, you know, I'm looking for a house. We're trying to buy a house. We can't find anything. And then the strangest weak link emerged. The wife of an old college friend from 10 years ago saw this at the corner of her eye, piped up, and wrote a note saying, well, I have a friend who's about to sell a house in that neighborhood. He's putting it on the market next week. It's not listed yet. You should contact him, and you could put in an early bid. And that's exactly what we did, and that's how we found our house. So these extraordinarily tiny weak links had brought exactly the type of novel information into my life that I was looking for. And when you think about it, there is no way, almost no way, in the offline world that type of information could ever be brokered, because what was the likelihood of anyone overhearing my wife just randomly saying out loud to herself, my goodness, there's Wi-Fi in this train station, somehow cascading out to a person she hadn't seen for 10 years. So this happens also in very funny ways in everyday life. I have an embarrassing story to tell of myself, which is that I went to South by Southwest in the spring, and I was going to go on stage, and I was going to talk about this writer. But I realized I had never actually pronounced his name or heard it pronounced, and I was about to go on stage and mispronounce it and look like an idiot in front of about 500 people. So I composed this tweet. I had about 10 minutes to go. I went on Twitter and I frantically said, could anyone help me out? How do you pronounce this name? I'm about to go on stage and I'm going to embarrass myself. Well, lo and behold, because I've got a network of people who are sort of just noticing what I'm asking at the corner of their eye, people started chiming in. I got an actual German speaker, some guy I've never met. He must have seen my desperate plea saying, well, you know, there's Goethe. And then Gideon Litchfield said it's Goethe, where the R's are British R's. So I was actually getting some real information from people I didn't know. Then my friends showed up, and they just started making jokes and hassling me, telling me that it was pronounced YOLO. What is that one? Yeah, pronounce it so it sounds completely wrong in North America, and then it's right. Someone else said it correct pronunciation is the way it sounds like you're about to hawk up something nasty. So these weak links become incredibly powerful for the resolution of even everyday small-scale queries of the sort that your close friends are unlikely to know, but distant strangers are also likely to. So we think in public, and we think in this curious way that allows us to keep this ESP connection with each other. But up until now, I've still been mostly just talking about, writing in text, And I think as we saw from that early picture of the Iranian missiles, people are becoming extraordinarily fluent in other modes of communication, in pictures and video, even in things like data. And so this is the next thing I noticed as I researched my book is what I called the rise of the new literacies, which is that people are becoming more and more literate in the expressive capabilities of things like the moving image and video and data. Now, once again, as with photography, this was the transition of something that used to be incredibly expensive that gradually became cheaper and cheaper. I mean, if you wanted to shoot video, 20 or 30 years ago, you needed a camera like that, one of these massive cameras. I used to go on video shoots with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation in the 80s. And the guys that carried the cameras were all former linebackers for the Canadian Football League because they were the only humans that could carry those things. I mean, I tried to pick it up from above, and I threw my back out. They weighed about 150 pounds. That's what a camera was. Now, as those cameras shrunk in size to the point where there's probably one inside almost everyone's pocket in this audience, it changed changed our relationship to the moving image, because now you could shoot things that were previously unshootable and share them in different ways and watch them in different ways too. Because beginning around 10 years ago, you saw things like the TiVo emerge, which allowed people to sort of do something they had never done before with the moving image, which is to slow it down and look at it frame by frame and repeat something and sort of stare at it, almost the way we leaf through a book and we go back over something. And this has actually had some really interesting effects in the patterns of how people watch TV. I'm actually going to mention a TV show, and I'm going to give some spoilers, so I need to find out before I go any further, is anyone in the crowd currently watching the fourth season of Breaking Bad? All right, good, excellent, we're fine. Usually there's two people that are doing that. They have to leave before I carry on. So in the fourth season of Breaking Bad is a show about a chemistry teacher who becomes a drug dealer, and he becomes increasingly evil as the seasons go on. And in around the fourth season, this mystery emerges. There's this little kid who starts getting ill. He becomes suddenly sick, and no one could figure out why. They thought maybe it's some sort of weird super flu, or is he being poisoned? And talk about public thinking. After every episode, I would go online to the discussion boards. It'd be like 10,000 words of people arguing about what was making this kid sick. And in the middle of this arguing went on for weeks. And in the middle of it, no one could figure out how this child was being made sick, this video emerged online. And it was put up by some mysterious person, never found out who they were, who's called JCham979. And it's a fascinating video. I encourage you to go look at it, because what this person did was they went through several different episodes of Breaking Bad and found these crucial moments that appeared to explain the mystery and broke them down on a frame-by-frame basis, capturing things that the human eye almost couldn't see. He made the argument that, in fact, a child was being poisoned with ricin, and the ricin had been planted on one of the other innocent characters during a pat-down. Something that, again, you wouldn't have noticed at all when it went through. But because he had the TiVo and because he was able to sort of look through things and parse video, he had this almost Talmudic scrutiny of the text. And it turned out he was right, because about 2 weeks later, when the big reveal at the end of the year was, Walter White had, in fact, poisoned the boy with ricin. So you're seeing video emerge as a way to talk about ideas that are hard to talk about in text. I decided a little while ago, I'm a guitar player, I decided a little while ago, about 2 years ago, that I wanted to try building a cigar box guitar. I was working on a friend's album, and we wanted to have the sound of a really, really gritty, old-fashioned hillbilly instrument. And one of the only ways to get that is to actually build a really old, gritty hillbilly instrument. So I decided, okay, I bought a bunch of power tools. I'm going to learn how to make these things. Well, I'm a nerd, of course, and so I hadn't used power tools in about 20 years, and I quickly apprehended upon opening these things up that I was going to sever a finger pretty easily if I didn't watch out. I had no idea what I was doing. And so, of course, being a nerd, I immediately just pulled out the instruction manuals, these power tools, and started reading them, whereupon I immediately realized there is no way you can learn how to use a power tool by reading the manual. You have to actually watch people doing things with it. You have to see it deployed. So I went to YouTube, and I spent a huge amount of time looking at these videos of people doing routing of very minute things, doing very careful stuff, seeing how they held their hands and how they held their bodies, and they would talk through the strategies. So there was all these hobbyists who had just done this incredibly generous thing of putting up these videos explaining how this worked. And I actually did make this is a good cigar box guitar right there. I cut the holes. I finally got the f-stop holes. There's no blood on it, as you can see. I still have all 10 fingers. You know, nothing bad happened. And that was because YouTube has started to become a place where we are formalizing and communicating a huge amount of knowledge that is very hard to communicate and formalize in the written word. This didn't used to be something the average person could do. They had knowledge locked in their heads that was communicatable in video, but they had no way to do it. So we're seeing that. We're also seeing photography. I mean, we talked about photography earlier. That's being revolutionized on all sorts of layers by weird new ways to take pictures, right? Like drones. So you're seeing drones being used now to take pictures, including environmentalists who can use them to fly over environmentally sensitive areas and see what's actually happening. Have the companies really stopped logging? What's the population of the animals that are inside these areas? And you're also seeing them even in just funny, silly places like weddings, right? So this is a new wedding photography, right? You know, the drone shot from 50 feet in the air, zooming in on the bride and groom. This is the hot new way to get married. And in many ways, just as the handheld camera revolutionized photography in the late 19th century, with the Brownie, changed photography from being something where you had to go in and sit down and have your picture taken, to where you could carry it along out and take pictures of people in the street. You're seeing technologies like drones changing the way we think of where photography is taken. Even data is changing this way. Like, if this is a computer from the 1950s, right? If you wanted to crunch a huge amount of data in the 1950s, you needed something like that. You needed a $30 million computer. And of course, now, those computers have shrunk to the point where everyone has one in their pocket inside this room, much more powerful than this. And it's capable of finding interesting data points in your life. So I'm not someone who exercises very much. I'm actually pretty sedentary. I should probably exercise more. But I have a lot of friends that are really crazy distance runners and whatnot. And so every once in a while, one of them will come up to me and they'll say, "Clive, I think my right knee is about to blow out." And I'll go, "Well, that's interesting. You know, does it hurt? I mean, you know, should you go to the doctor?" And like, no, it doesn't hurt. But when I look at the trend line on my data from my shoe monitor, I can see that I'm running 5% slower in the last quarter mile, and that always correlates with something about to go wrong with my knee. And so all these folks who are doing all these, wearing these Fitbits, are becoming really sophisticated data analysis of what their health actually looks like. It's taking patterns in their lives that used to be invisible and making them visible so they can now see them. And I've seen this not just with my sports-obsessed friends. I've seen this when I've gone into schools, and I've looked at them using tools that show kids the pattern of their learning. This is actually a screenshot from what's called the Khan Academy. It's an online free website that teachers and students can use, where they can sort of look at videos showing how math works, and then they can do problem sets. And the software tracks how well they're doing in the problem sets. And what you're looking at here is a girl in grade 7 out in California who I talked to, who is learning order of operations. And you can see that actually the way it works is she struggled for a long time. She wasn't doing very well. And then suddenly she would make a leap upwards and grab something. And then she would struggle for a bunch more days or a week and then make another leap up. And she told me that when she looked at this, it completely changed her idea of what learning looks like. Because up until then, she thought that learning was just like sort of a steady climb up a hill. Every day you learned a little bit more. Every day you were a little bit better. But she realized looking at this, that's not the way it works. You're grinding away at something. It feels like you're not learning anything, but at the back of your mind, you're figuring it out. And then one day, boom, you've got it. But then it's more grinding. And you have to get through that frustration. So she told me it made her more patient at the moments when she feels like she's not learning something. The ability to take things that were previously invisible and to visualize them changed the way she thought about learning and she thought about herself. So this is the third big trend that I've seen in my reporting. Thinking out loud in public, paying ambient attention to each other's knowledge, and the ability of these new literacies to get us talking and thinking about things we couldn't think about just in words. But the really interesting stuff over and over again, this is kind of the stories I found the most fun, really came together in the fourth big trend that I'm going to leave you with tonight. And that's a phenomenon of sort of connected minds. What happens when all these things we're doing individually combine together? When we discover through those multiples, the other weirdos who care about the same thing we care about, and we decide to start working on a project or solving a problem or doing something fun and interesting together. And we discover that our minds put together are enormously smarter than our minds apart. Now, this is an epiphany that I actually sort of learned, not really in the internet age, but about 30 years ago in the video game arcades of Toronto, because I'm 45, so I'm part of those kids that sat around playing Asteroids, this is one of those games, back in the 1980s. Now, one of the things that was funny about arcades was that they were actually social spheres, because only one kid could play the game at a time. The other five of us who wanted to play Asteroids would sort of sit in a semicircle around watching the other kid play the game. And we weren't just watching them, we were sort of talking about what the kid was doing. We'd be like, "Huh, that seems like a bad strategy," or like, "Did you see what that UFO just did?" And we would slowly figure out, by talking to each other, we would slowly figure out secrets about the games that not even the people who made the games were aware of. Like, for example, and this is very useful if you ever find yourself playing Asteroids again, if you can take that little ship up there in the corner and fly it right above the score, 880, and park it there without moving, you're completely invulnerable. Nothing can touch you, right? So you can just sit there watching asteroids float past, watching the UFOs go by. Every once in a while, in the 1980s, some teenager would manage this sort of zen-like feat, and we'd all just sit there staring at it for 15 minutes, watching this go. I mean, it was the 1980s. There wasn't much else to do. You know, this was high entertainment for us. But the point was, we became very sophisticated group thinkers and group observers. And this just started to happen more and more as games went on, because by the mid-1990s, I was playing games like this. This was Virtua Fighter 3 that was released to the Toronto arcades in 1996. Now, by this point in time, I had the very early version of the internet. I had these Usenet discussion groups. And there was a discussion group devoted to this game. So what started happening now is that I was now collaborating not just with the 5 kids in my arcade, but with 1,000 kids around the world, because each of us would go play the game, and I would discover 2 secret moves, and I would scribble them down on a scrap paper and go home and excitedly type them in to the discussion. And after about 3 months, we had listed 300 or 400 secret hidden moves inside this game. And this was greatly to the chagrin of the company that made the game, because they had boasted that it would take us about 3 or 4 years to figure all that stuff out. But they were slowly beginning to realize, all these game companies were slowly beginning to realize, that the ground had changed underneath them. They were accustomed to making games for an audience of one person. But now they realized they were making games for an audience of 1,000 people who were all talking to one another. And an audience of 1,000 people who are all talking to one another is enormously smarter and more clever than that one person sitting alone. So sort of this cognitive arms race started up in the video game world, where they kept on making games more and more and more complicated as the people who played them spent more and more time talking to each other. Because if you didn't make the game unbelievably complicated, it was sort of boring to this unbelievably intelligent hive mind of millions of game players around the world. It ultimately resulted in something like this. This is Skyrim, a game that came out 2 years ago. It's one of these Dungeons and Dragons type games. You're fighting, you know, great monsters. And I kind of laughed when I read Forbes magazine's review of the game, because it was some poor guy in his middle ages like me, and he played the game and he said, "How in goodness sakes does anyone learn how to play this thing? There's about 18 different possible character classes. There's 20 different abilities. There's about 100 different monsters and 1,000 different quests. Like, this is too complicated for any individual to ever understand." And he was completely correct, except that individuals don't understand it on their own. Because within about 24 hours of that game going online, someone put up a wiki devoted to Skyrim, and within 3 weeks, there were 17,000 articles written on the wiki by people who'd played the game and each individually observed one fascinating aspect of strategy, that they'd write up a little article. And they quickly developed this massive corpus of information about how to play the game. What strategies might be interesting, what strategies might be bad for you, what to do when you get stuck. There were about 40 or 400 maps and about 30 different videos of how to fight different bosses. Now, there have been a bunch of scientists who've looked at this, who've realized, wow, you know, if you can get people to collaborate, you know, you could get some terrific assistance on solving real-world hard scientific problems. And so the last story I'm gonna give you tonight is the story of David Baker. And he's in his 40s, he's about my age, so he grew up playing games and observing all this collective activity of game players. And he's the type of guy who studies how to make drugs to attack diseases in the body. Now, if you want to make a drug to attack the disease in your body, you have to understand how the protein in your body is causing that disease. You have to fold that protein. Because every protein starts life as like a you can think of it as like a long thread. And you roll it at each end, roll it together into a little ball, you know? And as you can imagine, there's millions of ways to roll that ball. And if you don't roll it the exact right way, you won't understand how it works, and you won't be able to make a drug that counteracts it. And so the way that David Baker and all his scientists would do this, they used to do it just brute force. They would have a supercomputer randomly rolling proteins over and over and over and over again in the hopes of just randomly getting the right combination. And as you can imagine, this is not a very efficient way to do it, because they would spend years with their supercomputer running full time and they would not get a correct fold. In fact, they would run out of supercomputer time. They didn't have enough time on the supercomputer. So David Baker's first move is he thought, well, there's a lot of people out there online, and maybe they would altruistically donate their computer to this research. So he created a beautiful little screensaver and you could download it. And when your computer was not doing anything, if you're not working on it, it would start folding proteins. And you could sort of, you could see it on screen, folding proteins, you know, randomly folding them. And he was right. There was about several tens of thousands of people altruistically downloaded it so they could donate their computer time, right? And so he thought, well, this is great, and all this data is flooding in. But then he started getting emails from the people who downloaded it. And they would say, well, David, here's the thing. I'm watching this thing do the folding, and it doesn't do a very good job. I can see after about three folds it's made a wrong move, and the whole thing is just not going to work. So rather than have the computer fold the protein, why don't you let me fold the protein? And so this great big light bulb went off in his head, because he realized that he had thought he was sitting on top of an amazing resource, the altruistic donation of thousands of computers. But he was actually sitting on top of something much more valuable, which is the altruistic donation of thousands of actual humans that are very good at solving problems in their minds and fantastic at visual thinking. So instead, he made this. He made his own video game. This is called Foldit, F-O-L-D.I-T. And it's a video game that challenges you by giving you an actual real protein and challenging you to fold it into the tightest ball possible. Now, this game is unbelievably hard. I wept like a baby when I tried playing it. It was just impossible for me, and I've been playing video games for 30 years. It is so hard to play that the people who started playing it realized that they were going to need to collaborate to do this well. And so they started immediately doing all this public thinking. They set up blogs where they would talk about, here's the strategies I'm doing, and here's how I'm folding things, and here's what I'm noticing works, here's what doesn't work. And they would comment on each other's blogs, arguing about their strategies. And they would set up Twitter feeds and Facebook feeds so they could pay attention to each other in that ambient way, so that anytime someone discovered something, all of the other people would immediately see it and figure it out and begin using it. And they formed into little clubs and groups. One was called the Foldit Contenders Group. One was called the Foldit Void Crushers Group, these little teams. And they would use new literacies. They would put up videos showing how they had folded these things, because, of course, it's not that easy to describe to someone how you've done this complex fold. You really want to see them doing it. So they got very, very good at folding these proteins, so good that David Baker decided he was going to give them a really massive challenge. So he took this problem of HIV protein folding that had baffled him and his fellow scientists for a decade. They had thrown untold millennia's worth of supercomputer power at this problem, and they had never folded this protein correctly. He said, okay, we can't do this. Can you try? He put it inside, and within 3 weeks, they figured it out. 3 weeks later, they'd figured out exactly how to fold the protein. That is how much better they were than all of the supercomputing power of dozens of universities put together. And in fact, they produced what is really one of the most amazing scientific papers I've seen in my life, because I don't know if you can see it from this far away, but it's co-authored not just by the scientists themselves, David Baker, but by the Foldit Contenders Group and the Foldit Void Crushers Group. So it's actually lists of video game teams are the co-authors on a scientific paper that appeared in Nature, one of the weirdest collaborations in the history of science. So as I leave you, I'm going to sort of summarize. These are really been the large-scale things I've seen over and over again as I've traveled around and talked to people. What are the things that they're finding that give them real value in the way we use our tools, you know? And they always say it's this combination of thinking in public, ambient contact, ambient awareness of what people are doing, the ability to talk in these new literacies, these weird new forms of audio and video and data, and the collaborative thought that emerges when they can work together on problems and talk about problems. And now you might imagine, you know, as I wrap up this talk and I've given all these amazing examples of this cognition that happens online, that I'm going to tell you, you know, to, you know, go home and leave here and, you know, pull out your phone and get on your computer and never get off again, because that's obviously so great, right? You know, but it is true that I also heard from talking to people, the people who are getting the most amazing value out of the internet, that they also always reserve time for what you could call private thinking, right? You know, if we're getting completely disconnected and spending the day totally offline, going for a long walk, reading books in depth. Because over and over again, what they told me, what I found is true in my own life, is that if you grant the force of the argument I'm making here, which is that there are these useful new environments for engaging in conversation and talk with other people, the old environments we used to have, that we still have, of not being online at all, of just, you know, being isolated, or having a long argument in a bar with a friend, or, you know, or sort of just, you know, thinking about something, pondering it over a book, you know, for hours and hours. Those are usefully different modes that we can't give up. And really, in many ways, what we live in, we live in a world of enormous cognitive diversity, where really what we have to engage in is what psychologists call metacognition, thinking about thinking. So I always tell people, you know, when you go to work, one of the first tasks of the day is to think, well, what type of problem am I trying to solve today? You know, is this something that would be better if I talked about it out loud to sort of see what other people think about it? Or is this something where it's only going to come from the creative aha moment of me just going for a long walk and thinking about it myself? And these are the interesting challenges of living and coping with this world, of figuring out how to avoid all these distractions of being constantly online by going offline and having that wonderful time while still enjoying the pleasures of the collaborative thinking that happens together. Because as, and I know how to pronounce his name, as Goethe said, you know, sharing is more difficult than we think. Thank you very much for your attention. I think we're going to have some Q&A now. I believe we have 15 minutes for Q&A. Is that it? Do we have any mics for the audience? No.
We have
some. Okay. All right. So if anyone has any questions, or even just not a question, just a response, a thought, throw up your hand and we'll talk about it. Yes, sir.
What is the future for security of
Give that to him so people can hear his question.
It's more.
Thank you. Your talk was great, by the way.
Thank you.
What is the future of the potential of achieving computer security in view of the collaborative power that you talked about?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you want to bring me the microphone?
Still have the
this still works. You can. All right, excellent. This to me is really a great question. And in fact, I devoted an entire chapter to thinking about this, because really, I mean, if you look at what I've been talking about here, there's this great externalization of thought that's happening, and there's these great conversations that are happening, but they're all mostly happening on commercial private sector platforms, right? Like all these tools, whether they're Twitter or whether they're Facebook or Instagram or something like that, they're all run by a company. And so this poses, you know, a few large risks to civic discourse. You know, one is that the corporations are trying to make money off us. So, and the way they make money off us is by selling us ads. So they like to collect as much information as they can about what we're saying so they can figure out, you know, some sort of profile to sell us ads. This is also what fuels a lot of the distraction, right? If you pull out your phone, I always say your phone is not really your phone. It's just a portal through which six multinational corporations are trying to grab your attention so they can sell you ads, right? And each one doesn't want you looking at the other one. They only want you looking at yours. So that's why they're constantly sending these stupid alerts and interrupting you and distracting you. So the first problem is that the corporate life of all this public expression gets wrapped up inside their commercial logic. The second problem, I think, which is even bigger, is the government problem that we've now seen, where, like, you know, the government spy agencies are just hoovering up all this data because it's a wonderful way to build a dossier on people, you know, to have it for years and years and years for retrospective surveillance. That strikes me as having, you know, potentially very alarming long-term implications. And what are the answers to that? You know, I asked a lot of you know, big political thinkers, are there ways that we can enjoy this open, civic, and cultural, and political, and even just fun and silly talk without it also becoming a permanent record for three-letter agencies and a way for large corporations to sell us ads? And what people told me was that there are a couple of routes for lessening the amount of surveillance and increasing the autonomy of individual people. One of them is legal routes, right? Like, you know, Europe has slightly better laws that allow people to have some control over the data and place limits on what spy agencies and corporations can do. those laws, you know, you could pass those laws in the U.S. It's not very easy, right? You know, Congress has trouble passing anything right now, let alone complicated laws that vouchsafe our autonomy online. But it's not impossible, because keep in mind that after the Edward Snowden revelations, about 4 months after that, the House, which is a pretty divided and messy institution, came within 7 votes of defunding the phone record collection program of the NSA. That was extremely close vote. That is not something I would have predicted a long time ago. So there may be more political steam building under this slowly than we think. The other solution that a lot of people talk about when I ask them, so what's our way out of this, is the development of tools that aren't really run by corporations. Like, what if you could have ways of talking to other people that didn't require you to go through some central intermediary like Facebook or Twitter, who's just collecting everything in one place? And it turns out that's actually not that hard to do. There's a lot of very public-minded nerds out there working on these very interesting tools. I've seen them that allow you to do all this conversation without it all living in one place where someone can scoop it up, you know, for commercial and for privacy. So now that stuff is happening very often in the fringes. It's in the sort of nerds, you know, who are just fiddling with it. But, you know, 20 years ago, the internet was in the same place. It was just fiddled with by the little nerds. It's moved to the mainstream. So my great hope is that over the next 15 or 20 years, these things that are privacy experiments, pro-privacy experiments, may actually become more and more a mainstream type of thing. That's my great hope. I can't guarantee it's going to happen. But that's the pathway. That's the best pathway that people have been able to describe to me. We've got one back there. Here, there's a microphone coming for you.
Who defines mainstream? So you can go into all the drop-down panels that come with that.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I've already heard about some nerds doing that in New Hampshire, I believe it is. They have a new Facebook kind of platform, and you sign an agreement that, you know, you've been invited in and that you're so cool that you're never going to allow corporations to come in and...
Yeah. That's a good point. I mean, I say mainstream basically as like when you know... Your otherwise technophobic aunt is doing it, basically. You know, like that. That's the very wide mainstream that I'm talking about. The truth is, you know, in a weird way, some of the best conversations that I've seen online have actually don't happen in any of these mainstream tools at all. They always happen actually in small communities of interest, right? Where people are gathering together for some purpose of common interest that is only they care about, no one else cares about. Now, that could be something even like a hobby, right? So you have something like Ravelry, right? Okay, 4 million people gathered in one website just to talk about knitting and crocheting. And it's massive and it's global. But because they talk about that, but they also talk about everything. They talk about their lives. They talk about their marriages. They talk about their politics. And so because they're there for one particular purpose, they have incredibly civil conversations because they sort of care about each other. Or I found over and over again, every time I would ask people, so what do you do online? And they would talk about there being a few big mainstreamy things they do, like Facebook and Twitter. But they would always have some strange little tiny discussion board they went to where they engaged in their strange thing with just 400 other people. And again, you found the highest quality, most respectful, interesting, multi-generational, national conversations going on because it's those small multiples that pull people together across really interesting. So at the margins are often where the most interesting conversation happens. And I think that's probably always going to be the case. Anyone else got something to throw out? All right, go for it, my friend.
I missed this movement. I was gone. And I would like to join it.
Sure.
You ask people who already know about it, they just say, get on there and fool around.
Yeah.
Is there maybe a more time-efficient way to do that?
Yeah. That's a good point. You know, the sad thing is I don't think there is. In the same sense that, like, human conversation is not very time-efficient either. I mean, you show up in a new town. How do you meet friends? How do you find people to talk to? You know, there's no easy way to do it, and you can spend a year and a half slowly figuring out what are your what are your networks of interesting people? What are your networks of support? Where do you go for interesting conversation? Where do you go to avoid the cranks and the freaks who are talking about X, Y, and Z? Every town has a geography exactly rather like the internet. So in one sense, I'm not sure there is any shortcuts because this is really human conversation, and human conversation has always been sort of a messy business. The short answer I give is that I always tell people that one of the simplest ways that I've found to sample something useful and interesting and fun is to use a simple tool, something that's very complicated, like Twitter is fairly simple, and I just have them say, ask for recommendations of other people that other people find interesting. Not people you know, strangers, just strangers who happen to be smart. Because if you were to look at my Twitter feed, in keeping with my division between weak and strong ties, I have my friends in there, but frankly, I enjoy hearing from them, but they're not, they don't often surprise me with what they say. I like to be surprised. So I try and find, I'm a science journalist, I try and find interesting scientists who are just, thinking and talking about what they're working on or things they're reading, and they tend to alert me to all sorts of interesting things. I find it pleasant. It's like being given a free gift of all this stuff to read and look at and think about. And so I often tell people, don't start with your friends. Start with interesting strangers in a field that you care about, And sometimes you can search for them and find them. Sometimes you find someone else who seems to be following them and look at their following. And you sort of garden together an interesting bunch of people to look at. And I find that that's probably the shortest cut there is to look for specifically very interesting folks, people that you admire even, or you think are well-read or well-thought, and see what they have to say. And that becomes very intellectually interesting for me. You make your own cocktail party, basically. And the upside, you're there and there. So the downside is it can become too darn interesting for the rest of your life. I mean, I'm a writer, and one of the last things I've learned not to look at my Twitter feed in the morning before I start work is it will invariably be more interesting than what I'm about to try and do for work. And so I will just sit there for 3 hours, oh my goodness, isn't that interesting? I can't believe this article they linked to. What are they saying about it? And I will starve. I do it as my reward after actually getting some work done. Yes, sir.
Is the ideology of independence and independent thinking
built? You mean like autonomous thinking, where you're not actually affected by the sort of voices of other people in that sense? Yeah, the type of private thinking that is forged in your own insight and not in worrying or thinking about what other people say, basically. Yeah. I don't think so. I used to worry about that too, but over and over again, when I would meet people who I thought were awfully good independent thinkers, they had a good orientation towards this stuff. They understood that it was just a conversation. It was just a way to sort of feed their minds, but that they held their own reserve. And I think that's probably always been true. I mean, all throughout history, keep in mind, all throughout history, we've had this exact same fear that you and I have had, which is that there's a loss of autonomy. We've seen it in different environments. In fact, when the great urbanization of Europe in the sort of 16th to 18th centuries, you go back and read the diaries and the political discussion then, and people were extremely unsettled by what was happening to their cognitive lives, because you went from being in an environment where you had, you lived in a town of perhaps 100 people, and that was it for the whole life. And now you're in London, and there's 350,000 people living in unbelievably tightly focused areas, and people were extremely concerned almost for their sense of autonomy. There was that great sense that I'm too exposed to all these other people. How do I forge a sense of individualism in this mass of humanity, right? And it took, I would argue it took centuries to sort of figure out the tricks for that autonomy. And we have some very funny, clever ones, like Irv Goffman, the sociologist in the 50s, used to enjoy wandering around large cities like New York and observing the ways in which people navigated highly congested environments while not going nuts. And one of his favorite observations is what they call civil inattention. So civil inattention is when you're at the bus stop, or you're on the bus, or you're on the subway, or on the plane, and the couple next, you're having a screaming fight about their relationship. You have to pretend not to be listening to them, basically, you know. And if you're really adept at living in an urban environment, you actually aren't listening to them. You actually tune them out. You've got your novel, and you're just like they're about to divorce, and you don't notice it, you know. But this took hundreds of years to sort of figure out these mechanisms for individual autonomy, so we wouldn't go nuts. The same type of thing happened with the telephone, and with pretty much every medium that came along. Anything that changes the way we communicate with each other tends to unsettle our existing patterns of thinking. And in the short run, I think sometimes they can definitely make things worse for us on an individual level before we figure out what these new protocols are. And I think we're still in the middle of that phase. You know, we're still figuring out. I know a lot of people who I think spend way too much time on social media. And I'm like, you know, y'all need to calm down and then, you know, go for a walk, smell the flowers, basically. And it may well be that, you know, 15 years from now, the average person will have figured out, you know, a balance better than what we have right now. But there are these inflection points. They do come along, and you see them historically repeated over and over again. So in the long run, my answer is no, I don't think I am worried. But I do think that it requires some attention and some thinking about what our relationship is to this environment, for sure.
I've read that there was, especially outside the city area, there was a lot of resistance to the radio.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Because
yeah. It was very hypnotic sort of a feel, and I've read these essays that were written particularly by children, and the idea that it was hard for them to stop listening. You know, it was getting in the way of their schoolwork. You know, dad was listening to the radio, and the kids literally would not do their homework because it was too compelling. And you understand that's actually true. If this is a completely new experience, it's pretty hard to pull away from that, right? You know, it would take some decades for it to become background music while you studied. You know. So we do adapt, but for the generation that has to figure out the adaptation, things are not always pleasant, you know? And we're in the middle of that right now.
Yeah. This is the foundation of the
war. No, I don't think we're going to have any board. People are very social. They're very social. They like to chatter a lot. We're discovering that now. But most smart people I know hold their own counsel still. I'm happy to report from my experience. I hope not, anyway. I don't want to wear one of those things in my eye. Yeah. Did we have any other ones? I thought I saw some in the hand in the middle of that one. Anyone else got something they want to throw out? All right, up here, my friend. Let's get the microphone around.
I read a thing this morning about the 10 things that are going to happen to human beings and machines in the future, and it could be within 20 years.
Okay.
And that is, your computer screen is going to be in your cornea.
In your cornea, yeah.
And your keypad is going to be in your fingertips. and a chip the size of a grain of salt is going to have an incredible amount of information in it that you can kind of insert anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you're going to have all these things are hardwired into you. And that technology isn't that far away. How's that all going to work?
Well, you know, I have a little bit of an... I wondered about this myself last year because I saw the advent of these wearable computers, right? You know, like Google Glass. And I wanted to figure out what that was going to be like. So I ordered a copy, and I wore them for 4 months for a story for the New York Times Magazine. And it was interesting because you could sort of get a glimpse of what this kind of crazy world of really embedded technology would look like. It turned out to be a kind of a failed experiment for me. I mean, there were very few times when it was actually useful for me to have this screen in my eye. Like, there was almost no situation in which it did something that improved upon me just maybe looking at my phone or whatnot. And along the way, so it did maybe two things that were useful, but it did about 100 things that were terrible. Mostly the fact that it creeped everyone out around me, right? Because I'm walking around with a computer in my face, and it's got a camera pointing out of it, which was unbelievably unsettling to everyone for understandable reasons, because they can't tell if I'm recording them. So I would go onto the subway in New York, and I would literally stare at the ground because I didn't want anyone to think I was recording them. But if there's one thing creepier than a guy with a computer on his face, it's a guy with a computer on his face who refuses to make eye contact with you. So like, I would like clear a subway train, you know, like, you know, dude with a computer on his face staring at the ground. In a way, it was actually heartening because I realized that people do, I think, maybe draw some lines that some of those technologies we may discover some of those technologies that people actually do resist some of them and are not particularly interested in having a computer in their eye. One of the things that was very unexpected with Google Glass was that even in the rare situations where it's kind of fun, I've got a text message here, I've got a web page or whatever, it was very unsettling to my wife. Because there's an asymmetry to the informational experience, which is to say, all other forms of tools we use to look at information, ranging from a book to a clipboard to a mobile phone to a laptop, are not secret. I mean, like, you know, someone else could see what I've got on my phone. Someone else could see what is in my book. Someone else can see, what's on my clipboard. Someone else can see what's on my laptop screen. But when the screen is right up against your eye, people have no idea what you're looking at. So, like, you know, when the screen went on in conversation, they'd also be like, all right, so what are you staring at now, you know? And so, and I think there's a very, very deep social contract that type of information breaks. And I'm not completely sure it's actually going to take off. Like, I think there are other types of wearable computers that people might like the wrist thing, you know, because it's small, it's glanceable, but it is not this inscrutable mystery inside your eyeball. The larger question, though, is you know, that for me anyway lurks underneath the technologies like that when you describe that list to me is almost a sense of humanity, like. Are there limits that I should draw between my reliance upon machines to do this work of helping me think, right? And you know, we have historically spent a long time sort of coming to terms with what types of technologies we do and don't want to help us think. And it's gone that way since the very beginning of cognitive technologies, like Socrates, you know, in the Phaedrus. So it's a wonderful little Platonic dialogue. You could go home and it's on the internet. Read it tonight. It's fun. And it's a great dialogue because he talks about this weird new technology called writing, and he's really unsettled by it. It starts off when he's walking down the street and he's just, you know, looking for someone to get in an argument with and, you know, concern troll them. And he sees his student Phaedrus. And Phaedrus is walking along and Phaedrus says, you know, I just came from this amazing speech. I heard this speech on love. It was so amazing, Socrates. You can't imagine how great it was. And so Socrates goes, all right, well then, you know, just recite it for me. You know, because he expected that, like, ancient Greeks had these techniques for memorizing, right? You know, they didn't have the written word very much yet. So if you went to a speech, you had to memorize what they were saying, because that was it. There was no written record. And Phaedrus says, I can't do that. I'm sorry. It was too great a speech. I can't recite it for you. And, you know, Socrates bugs him again and says, come on, just please, tell me what he said. You know, you're a Greek. You should have memorized it. And so finally, at the end, he's teasing me. He's going, okay, what do you have underneath your robe? And he pulls out from underneath the robe a scroll with the speech written down on it. And he's totally busted because he's making the transition to this new technology writing where instead of having to memorize everything in your head, it's going to be written down. And this is unbelievable. And so Socrates starts off in this very eloquent, funny speech about the dangers of writing. Because if we start relying on the printed page to remember things, this will corrode our internal memories. If the knowledge is not inside our heads, how can it be truly said to be knowledge? Can it truly be said to be wisdom? More importantly, he was really concerned about the death of dialectic and debate, because for him, knowledge was formed with two people talking to each other, arguing, so that one person could challenge someone else and challenge back, and a document was dead, it was inert. If I hand you my book, and you think I've written something stupid in chapter two, the book cannot argue back to your argument. And so for these reasons, he thought that reliance on an externalized technology was going to doom our cognition. And this really becomes a template for all the concerns we've had about technology, because he was both, I mean, he was wrong and he was right, you know? He was right in that it's true that once we were able to write things down, we pretty much stopped mass memorizing things. You know, I don't think anyone in this room has most of the Iliad committed to memory, right? But he was wrong in that he couldn't envision the new complicated forms of thought that were going to emerge when you could consult a large array of documents, when you had a library and you could read something and then maybe reread it a few days later, and arrange different things on your desks, and use the fact that that this technology was doing this very creepy thing, which is holding knowledge outside your head, would allow you to formalize more complicated thoughts. And it really took us, you know, hundreds of years to figure out how to do that correctly. Like, you know, Linnaeus had to invent the note card, you know, like in the medieval period. And then, you know, a couple of medieval scholars had to spend two centuries arguing over how to take notes. You know, the great note-taking wars of the 15th century is something I've been thinking of writing an essay about. And in each case, there were these concerns that feel like the same ones I feel when I read those articles. You know, I have that same feeling of like, wait a minute, there's things I don't want to come between me and the world. I don't want parts of my mind to live outside my body that way. But the truth is, one of the great gifts of humanity has been actually figuring out these ways to use tools to hold thoughts outside of us, to hold knowledge outside of us, yet in an intimate dance with our minds. It's both there and it's not there. In fact, Daniel Wegner refers to this as transactive memory, the fact that a huge amount of what we know is actually not even in here. It's stored in not only notes and books, but in the people around us. You know, the way that your partner, spouses get in fights because one of them can always remember where the socks are and the other one can always remember where the keys are, but the other one can't remember that one. They're just like, wow, come you can't remember that? You can't remember that? It's because they're actually relying on each other to remember things. Transactive memory. So we have a transactive relationship with the technologies around us too, and it is, I think, frequently unsettling. Even as it gives us its gifts, it's unsettling. So that's a long way of saying I don't actually know the answer to that question. I mean, all those things you mentioned sort of stab me in the stomach and make me think, wow, that's freaky. I don't think I want that, you know. And I can tell with Google Glass I don't, because I tried it. But there might be other ones that I turn it to have to be the Socrates on. That I can't see the good things that are on the other side because it unsettles me so much. And maybe it'll be a later generation that figures that out. I don't know.
Clyde, thank you for coming out to Hudson, and thank you for tonight's lesson. I did purchase your book. I just have an opinion, which may not mean anything to the people here tonight, however. I have read that the chip that will be either acceptable or non-acceptable, the chip is something that we are not supposed to take. The chip actually represents an antichrist, right, which is a mark of the beast.
Yes.
And I'm not speaking biblically, however,
sure,
I've been told not to take that chip.
Sure. Yeah, no, I've heard the point made
on behalf of the Christians here. I'm a Christian, so I don't think I'm going to take that chip. I believe in Christ.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for talking. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.